since that's where my mother and father came from. I had heard this one before, as had, I imagine, most visitors to that office, and I gave it the dutiful smile it was meant to elicit. Will Home Bank and Trust loan you $35? You bet! I'm tempted to put it on a man-to-man basis and do the deal out of my own wallet, except I never carry more than what it takes to pay for my lunch at the splendid diner and a shoe shine at the barber shop. Too much money's a constant temptation, even for a wily old cuss like me. And besides, business is business. But, he raised his finger, you don't need $35. Sad to say, I do. I wondered if he knew why. He might have. He was, indeed, a wily old cuss. But so was Harl Cottery, and Harl was also a shamed old cuss that fall. No, you don't. You need $750. That's what you need. And you could have it today. Either bank it, or walk out with it in your pocket. All the same to me, either way. You paid off the mortgage on your place 3 years ago. It's free and clear. So there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't turn around and take out another mortgage. It's done all the time, my boy, and by the best people. You'd be surprised at some of the paper we're carrying. All the best people. Yes, sir. I thank you very kindly, Mr. Stoppenhauser, but I don't think so. That mortgage was like a gray cloud over my head the whole time it was in force, and, Wilf, that's the point. The finger went up again. This time it wagged back and forth like the pendulum of the regulator. That is exactly the rootin' tootin' cowboy shootin' point. It's the fellows who take out a mortgage and then feel they're always walking around in sunshine who end up defaulting and losing their valuable property. Fellows like you, who carry that bank paper like a barrel load of rocks on a gloomy day, are the fellows who always pay back. And do you want to tell me that there aren't improvements you could make? A roof to fix? A little more livestock? He gave me a sly and roguish look. Maybe even indoor plumbing, like your neighbor down the road? Such things pay for themselves, you know. You could end up with improvements that far outweigh the cost of a mortgage. Value for money, Wilf. Value for money! I thought it over. At last I said, I'm very tempted, sir. I won't lie about that. No need to. A banker's office, the priest's confessional, very little difference. The best men in this county have sat in that chair, Wilf, the very best. But I only came in for a shorty loan, which you have kindly granted, and this new proposal needs a little thinking about. A new idea occurred to me, one that was surprisingly pleasant. And I ought to talk it over with my boy, Henry. Hank, as he likes to be called now. He's getting to an age where he needs to be consulted, because what I've got will be his someday. Understood, completely understood. But it's the right thing to do, believe me. He got to his feet and stuck out his hand. I got to mine and shook it. You came in here to buy a fish, Wilf. I'm offering to sell you a pole. Much better deal. Thank you. And leaving the bank, I thought, I'll talk it over with my son. It was a good thought, a warm thought in a heart that had been chilly for months. The mind is a funny thing, isn't it? Preoccupied as I was by Mr. Stoppenhauser's unsolicited offer of a mortgage, I never noticed that the vehicle I'd come in had been replaced by the one Henry had taken to school. I'm not sure I would have noticed right away, even if I'd had less weighty matters on my mind. They were both familiar to me. After all, they were both mine. I only realized when I was leaning in to get the crank and saw a folded piece of paper held down by a rock on the driving seat. I just stood there for a moment, half in and half out of the tee, one hand on the side of the cab, the other reaching under the seat, which was where we kept the crank. I suppose I knew why Henry had left school and made this swap, even before I pulled his note from beneath the makeshift paperweight and unfolded it. The truck was more reliable on a long trip. A trip to Omaha, for instance. "Papa, I have taken the truck. I guess you know where I am going. Leave me alone. I know you can send Sheriff Jones after me to bring me back, but if you do, I will tell everything. You might think I'd change my mind because I'm just a kid, but I won't. Without Shan, I don't care about nothing. I love you, Papa, even if I don't know why, since everything we did has brought me misery. Your loving son, Henry Hank James." I drove back to the farm in a daze. I think some people waved to me. I think even Sally Cottery, who was minding the Cottery's roadside vegetable stand, waved to me. And I probably waved back, but I have no memory of doing so. For the first time since Sheriff Jones had come out to the farm, asking his cheerful, no-answers-needed questions and looking at everything with his cold, inquisitive eyes, the electric chair seemed like a real possibility to me. So real I could almost feel the buckles on my skin as the leather straps were tightened on my wrists and above my elbows. He would be caught, whether I kept my mouth shut or not. That seemed inevitable to me. He had no money, not even 6 bits to fill the truck's gas tank, so he'd be walking long before he even got to Elkhorn. If he managed to steal some gas, he'd be caught when he approached the place where she was now living, Henry assumed as a prisoner. It had never crossed his unfinished mind that she might be a willing guest. Surely Harlan had given the person in charge, Sister Camilla, Henry's description. Even if he hadn't considered the possibility of the outraged swain making an appearance at the sight of his lady love's durance vial, Sister Camilla would have. In her business, she had surely dealt with outraged swains before. My only hope was that, once accosted by the authorities, Henry would keep silent long enough to realize that he'd been snared by his own foolishly romantic notions rather than by my interference. Hoping for a teenage boy to come to his senses is like betting on a long shot at the horse track, but what else did I have? As I drove into the dooryard, a wild thought crossed my mind. Leave the tea running, pack a bag, and take off for Colorado. The idea lived for no more than 2 seconds. I had money, $75, in fact, but the tea would die long before I crossed the state line at Julesburg. And that wasn't the important thing. If it had been, I could always have driven as far as Lincoln and then traded the tea and 60 of my dollars for a reliable car. No, it was the place. The home place. My home place. I had murdered my wife to keep it, and I wasn't going to leave it now because my foolish and immature accomplice had gotten it into his head to take off on a romantic quest. If I left the farm, it wouldn't be for Colorado. It would be for state prison. And I would be taken there in chains. That was Monday. There was no word on Tuesday or Wednesday. Sheriff Jones didn't come to tell me Henry had been picked up hitchhiking on the Lincoln-Omaha Highway. And Harl Cottery didn't come to tell me, with puritanical satisfaction, no doubt, that the Omaha police had arrested Henry at Sister Camilla's request, and he was currently sitting in the pokey, telling wild tales about knives and wells and burlap bags. All was quiet on the farm. I worked in the garden harvesting pantry vegetables. I mended fence, I milked the cows, I fed the chickens, and I did it all in a daze. Part of me, and not a small part either, believed that all of this was a long and terribly complex dream from which I would awake with Arlette snoring beside me and the sound of Henry chopping wood for the morning fire. Then on Thursday, Mrs. McReady, the dear and portly widow who taught academic subjects at Hemingford School, came by in her own Model T to ask me if Henry was all right. "There's an intestinal distress going around," she said. "I wondered if he caught it. He left very suddenly." "He's distressed, all right," I said. "But it's a love bug instead of a stomach bug. He's run off, Mrs. MacReady." Unexpected tears, stinging and hot, rose in my eyes. I took the handkerchief from the pocket on the front of my bibles, but some of them ran down my cheeks before I could wipe them away. When my vision was clear again, I saw that Mrs. MacReady, who meant well by every child, even the difficult ones, was near tears herself. She must have known all along what kind of bug Henry was suffering from. "He'll be back, Mr. James. Don't you fear. I've seen this before, and I expect to see it a time or two again before I retire, although that time's not so far away as it once was." She lowered her voice as if she feared George the Rooster or one of his feathered harem might be a spy. "The one you want to watch out for is her father. He's a hard and unbending man, not a bad man, but hard."
"I know," I said, "and I suppose you know where his daughter is now."
She lowered her eyes. It was answer enough.
"Thank you for coming out, Mrs. MacReady. Can I ask you to keep this to yourself?"
"Of course, but the children are already whispering."
"Yes, they would be."
"Are you on the exchange, Mr. James?" She looked for telephone wires. "I see you are not. Never mind. If I hear anything, I'll come out and tell you."
"You mean if you hear anything before Harlan Cottery or Sheriff Jones?"
"God will take care of your son. Shannon, too. You know, they really were a lovely couple. Everyone said so. Sometimes the fruit ripens too early, and a frost kills it. Such a shame, such a sad, sad shame."
She shook my hand, a man's strong grip, and then drove away in her flivver. I don't think she realized that at the end she'd spoken of Shannon and my son in the past tense.
On Friday, Sheriff Jones came out, driving the car with the gold star on the door. And he wasn't alone. Following along behind was my truck. My heart leaped at the sight of it, then sank again when I saw who was behind the wheel, Lars Olsen. I tried to wait quietly while Jones went through his ritual of arrival, belt hitching, forehead wiping even though the day was chilly and overcast, hair brushing. I couldn't do it. "Is he all right? Did you find him?"
"No. Nope. Can't say we did."
He mounted the porch steps.
"Line rider over east of Limebiska found the truck, but no sign of the kid. We might know better about the state of his health if you'd reported this when it happened, wouldn't we?"
"I was hoping he'd come back on his own," I said dully. "He's gone to Omaha. I don't know how much I need to tell you, Sheriff." Lars Olsen had meandered into auditory range, ears all but flapping.
"Go on back to my car, Olsen," Jones said. "This is a private conversation."
Lars, a meek soul, scurried off without demur. Jones turned back to me. He was far less cheerful than on his previous visit, and had dispensed with the bumbling persona as well.
"I already know enough, don't I? That your kid got Harl Cottery's daughter in the family way, and has probably gone herring off to Omaha. He run the truck off the road into a field of high grass when he knew the tank was about dry. That was smart. He get that kind of smart from you? Or from Arlette?"
I said nothing, but he'd given me an idea, just a little one, but it might come in handy.
"I'll tell you one thing he did that we'll thank him for," Jones said. "Might keep him out of jail, too. He yanked all the grass from under the truck before he went on his merry way, so the exhaust wouldn't catch it afire, you know. Start a big prairie fire that burned a couple thousand acres, a jury might get a bit touchy, don't you think? Even if the offender was only 15 or so."
"Well, it didn't happen, Sheriff. He did the right thing, so why are you going on about it?" I knew the answer, of course. Sheriff Jones might not give a hoot in a high wind for the likes of Andrew Lester, attorney at law, but he was good friends with Harl. They were both members of the newly formed Elks Lodge, and Harl had it in for my son.
"A little touchy, aren't you?"
He wiped his forehead again, then resettled his Stetson. Well, I might be touchy, too, if it was my son. And you know what? If it was my son and Harl Cottery was my neighbor, my good neighbor, I might have just taken a run down there and said, Harl, you know what? I think my son might be going to try and see your daughter. You want to tell someone to be on the peep for him? But you didn't do that either, did you? The idea he'd given me was looking better and better, and it was almost time to spring it. He hasn't shown up wherever she is, has he? Not yet, no. He may still be looking for it. I don't think he ran away to see Shannon, I said. Why, then? Do they have a better brand of ice cream there in Omaha? Because that's the way he was headed, sure as your life. I think he went looking for his mother. I think she may have gotten in touch with him. That stopped him for a good 10 seconds, long enough for a wipe of the forehead and a brush of the hair. Then he said, How would she do that? A letter would be my best guess. The Hemingford Home Grocery was also the post office where all the general delivery went. They would have given it to him when he went in for candy or a bag of peanuts, as he often does on his way back from school. I don't know for sure, Sheriff, any more than I know why you came out here acting like I committed some kind of crime. I wasn't the one who knocked her up. You ought to hush that kind of talk about a nice girl. Maybe yes and maybe no. But this was as much a surprise to me as it was to the Cotteries, and now my boy is gone. They at least know where their daughter is. Once again, he was stumped. Then he took out a little notebook from his back pocket and jotted something in it. He put it back and asked, You don't know for sure that your wife got in touch with her kid, though. That's what you're telling me? It's just a guess? I know he talked a lot about his mother after she left, but then he stopped. And I know he hasn't shown up at that home where Harlan and his wife stuck Shannon. And on that score, I was as surprised as Sheriff Jones, but awfully grateful. Put the two things together, and what do you get? I don't know, Jones said, frowning. I truly don't. I thought I had this figured out. But I've been wrong before, haven't I? Yes, and will be again. We are all bound in error. That's what the book says. But good God, kids make my life hard. If you hear from your son, Wilfred, I'd tell him to get his skinny ass home and stay away from Shannon Cottery if he knows where she is. She won't want to see him. Guarantee you that. Good news is no prairie fire, and we can't arrest him for stealing his father's truck. No, I said grimly. You'd never get me to press charges on that one. But, he raised his finger, which reminded me of Mr. Stoppenhauser at the bank. 3 days ago in Lime Bisca, not so far from where the rider found your truck, someone held up that grocery in Ethel Station on the edge of town. The one with the blue bonnet girl on the roof? Took $23. I got the report sitting on my desk. It was a young fella. Dressed in old cowboy clothes, with a bandana pulled up over his mouth, and a plainsman hat slouched down over his eyes. The owner's mother was tending the counter, and the fellow menaced her with some sort of tool. She thought it might have been a crowbar or a pry rod, but who knows? She's pushing 80, and half blind. It was my time to be silent. I was flabbergasted. At last I said, Henry left from school, Sheriff, and so far as I can remember, he was wearing a flannel shirt and corduroy trousers that day. He didn't take any of his clothes, and in any case, he doesn't have any cowboy clothes, if you mean boots and all. Nor does he have a plainsman's hat. He could have stolen those things too, couldn't he? If you don't know anything more than what you just said, you ought to stop. I know you're friends with Harlan. Now, this has nothing to do with that. It did, and we both knew it, but there was no reason to go any farther down that road. Maybe my 80 acres didn't stack up very high against Harlan Cottery's 400, but I was still a landowner and a taxpayer, and I wasn't going to be browbeaten. That was the point I was making, and Sheriff Jones had taken it. My son's not a robber, and he doesn't threaten women. That's not how he acts and not the way he was raised.
Not until just lately, anyway,
a voice inside whispered.
Probably just a drifter looking for a quick payday, Jones said. But I felt like I had to bring it up, and so I did. And we don't know what people might say, do we? Talk gets around. Everybody talks, don't they? Talk's cheap. The subject's closed as far as I'm concerned. Let the Lyme County Sheriff worry about what goes on in Lyme Biscuit. That's my motto. But you should know that the Omaha police are keeping an eye on the place where Shannon Cottery's at. Just in case your son gets in touch, you know.
He brushed back his hair, then resettled his hat a final time.
Maybe he'll come back on his own, no harm done. And we can write this whole thing off as, I don't know, a bad debt.
Fine. Just don't call him a bad son, unless you're willing to call Shannon Cottery a bad daughter. The way his nostrils flared suggested he didn't like that much, but he didn't reply to it. What he said was,
if he comes back and says he's seen his mother, let me know, would you? We've got her on the books as a missing person.
Silly, I know, but the law is the law. I'll do that, of course. He nodded and went to his car. Lars had settled behind the wheel. Jones shooed him over. The sheriff was the kind of man who did his own driving. I thought about the young man who'd held up the store and tried to tell myself that my Henry would never do such a thing. And even if he were driven to it, he wouldn't be sly enough to put on clothes he'd stolen out of somebody's barn or bunkhouse. But Henry was different now, and murderers learn slyness, don't they? It's a survival skill. I thought that maybe, but no, I won't say it that way. It's too weak. This is my confession, my last word on everything, and if I can't tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, what good is it? What good is anything? It was him. It was Henry. I'd seen by Sheriff Jones's eyes that he only brought up that side-of-the-road robbery because I wouldn't kowtow to him the way he thought I should have. But I believed it, because I knew more than Sheriff Jones. After helping your father to murder your mother, what was stealing some new clothes and waving a crowbar in an old granny's face? No such much. And if he tried it once, he would try it again, once those $23 were gone. Probably in Omaha, where they would catch him. And then the whole thing might come out. Almost certainly would come out. I climbed to the porch, sat down, and put my face in my hands. Days went by. I don't know how many. Only that they were rainy. When the rain comes in the fall, outside chores have to wait, and I didn't have enough livestock or outbuildings to fill the hours with inside chores. I tried to read, but the words wouldn't seem to string together, although every now and then a single one would seem to leap off the page and scream. Murder, guilt, betrayal, words like those. Days, I sat on the porch with a book in my lap, bundled into my sheepskin coat against the damp and the cold, watching the rainwater drip off the overhang. Nights, I lay awake until the small hours of the morning, listening to the rain on the roof overhead. It sounded like timid fingers tapping for entry. I spent too much time thinking about Arlette in the well with Elphys. I began to fancy that she was still... not alive. I was under stress, but not crazy, but somehow aware, somehow watching developments from her makeshift grave, and with pleasure.
"Do you like how things have turned out, Wilf?" she'd ask if she could, and in my imagination did. "Was it worth it? What do you say?"
One night, about a week after Sheriff Jones's visit, as I sat trying to read The House of the Seven Gables, Arlette crept up behind me, reached around the side of my head, and tapped the bridge of my nose with one cold, wet finger. I dropped the book on the braided sitting room rug, screamed, and leaped to my feet.
When I did, the cold fingertip ran down to the corner of my mouth. Then it touched me again on top of my head, where the hair was getting thin. This time I laughed, a shaky, angry laugh, and bent to pick up my book. As I did, the finger tapped a third time, this one on the nape of the neck, as if my dead wife were saying, "Have I got your attention yet, Wilf?" I stepped away, so the fourth tap wouldn't be in the eye, and looked up. The ceiling overhead was discolored and dripping. The plaster hadn't started to bulge yet, but if the rain continued, it would. It might even dissolve and come down in chunks. The leak was above my special reading place. Of course it was. The rest of the ceiling looked fine, at least so far. I thought of Stoppenhauser saying, "Do you want to tell me there aren't improvements you could make? A roof to fix?" And that sly look as if he had known, as if he and Arlette were in on it together. "Don't be getting such things in your head," I told myself. "Bad enough that you keep thinking of her down there. Have the worms gotten her eyes yet, I wonder? Have the bugs eaten away her sharp tongue, or at least blunted it?" I went to the table in the far corner of the room, got the bottle that stood there, and poured myself a good-sized hooker of brown whiskey. My hand trembled, but only a little. I downed it in two swallows. I knew it would be a bad business to turn such drinking into a habit, but it's not every night that a man feels his dead wife tap him on the nose. And the hooch made me feel better, more in control of myself. I didn't need to take on a $750 mortgage to fix my roof. I could patch it with scrap lumber when the rain stopped. But it would be an ugly fix, would make the place look like what my mother would have called trash poor. Nor was that the point. Fixing a leak would take only a day or two. I needed work that would keep me through the winter. Hard labor would drive out thoughts of Arlette on her dirt throne, Arlette in her burlap snood. I needed home improvement projects that would send me to bed so tired that I'd sleep right through and not lie there listening to the rain and wondering if Henry was out in it, maybe coughing from the grip. Sometimes work is the only thing, the only answer. The next day I drove to town in my truck and did what I never would have thought of doing if I hadn't needed to borrow $35. I took out a mortgage for $750. In the end, we are all caught in devices of our own making. I believe that. In the end, we are all caught. In Omaha that same week, a young man, wearing a plainsman's hat, walked into a pawn shop on Dodge Street and bought a nickel-plated .32-caliber pistol. He paid with $5 that had no doubt been handed to him under duress by a half-blind old woman who did business beneath the sign of the Blue Bonnet Girl. The next day, a young man wearing a flat cap on his head and a red bandana over his mouth and nose walked into the Omaha branch of the First Agricultural Bank, pointed a gun at a pretty young teller named Rhoda Penmark, and demanded all the money in her drawer. She passed over about $200, mostly in ones and fives, the grimy kind farmers carry rolled up in the pockets of their bib overalls. As he left, stuffing the money into his pants with one hand, clearly nervous, he dropped several bills on the floor. The portly guard, a retired policeman, said, "Son, you don't want to do this." The young man fired his .32 into the air. Several people screamed. "I don't want to shoot you either," the young man said from behind his bandana, "but I will, if I have to. Fall back against that post, sir, and stay there if you know what's good for you. I've got a friend outside watching the door." The young man ran out, already stripping the bandana from his face. The guard waited for a minute or so, then went out with his hands raised. He had no sidearm, just in case there really was a friend. There wasn't, of course. Hank James had no friends in Omaha, except for the one with his baby growing in her belly. I took $200 of my mortgage money in cash and left the rest in Mr. Stoppenhauser's bank. I went shopping at the hardware, the lumber yard, and the grocery store, where Henry might have gotten a letter from his mother, if she were still alive to write one. I drove out of town in a drizzle that had turned to slashing rain by the time I got home. I unloaded my newly purchased lumber and shingles, did the feeding and milking, then put away my groceries, mostly dry goods and staples that were running low, without Arlette to ride herd on the kitchen. With that chore done, I put water on the wood stove to heat for a bath and stripped off my damp clothes. I pulled the wad of money out of the right front pocket of my crumpled bibles, counted it, and saw I still had just shy of $160. Why had I taken so much in cash? Because my mind had been elsewhere. Where elsewhere, pray? On Arlette and Henry, of course. Not to mention Henry and Arlette. They were pretty much all I thought about on those rainy days. I knew it wasn't a good idea to have so much cash money around. It would have to go back to the bank, where it could earn a little interest, although not nearly enough to equal the interest on the loan, while I was thinking about how best to put it to work. But in the meantime, I should lay it by someplace safe. The box with the red horse hat in it came to mind. It was where she'd stashed her own money, and it had been safe there for God knew how long. There was too much in my wad to fit in the band, so I thought I'd put it in the hat itself. It would only be there until I found an excuse to go back to town. I went into the bedroom, stark naked, and opened the closet door. I shoved aside the box with her white church hat in it, then reached for the other one. I'd pushed it all the way to the back of the shelf and had to stand on tiptoe to reach it. There was an elastic cord around it. I hooked my finger under it to pull it forward. Was momentarily aware that the hat box felt much too heavy, as though there were a brick inside it instead of a bonnet, and then there was a strange freezing sensation, as though my hand had been doused in ice water. A moment later, the freeze turned to fire. It was a pain so intense that it locked all the muscles in my arm. I stumbled backwards, roaring in surprise and agony and dropping money everywhere. My finger was still hooked into the elastic, and the hat box came tumbling out. Crouched on top of it was a Norway rat that looked all too familiar. You might say to me, "Wilf, one rat looks like another, and ordinarily you'd be right." But I knew this one. Hadn't I seen it running away from me with a cow's teat jutting from its mouth like the butt of a cigar? The hatbox came free of my bleeding hand, and the rat tumbled to the floor. If I had taken time to think, it would have gotten away again, but conscious thinking had been canceled by pain, surprise, and the horror I suppose almost any man feels when he sees blood pouring from a part of his body that was whole only seconds before. I didn't even remember that I was as naked as the day I was born, just brought my right foot down on the rat. I heard its bones crunch and felt its gut squash. Blood and liquefied intestines squirted from beneath its tail and doused my left ankle with warmth. It tried to twist around and bite me again. I could see its large front teeth gnashing, but it couldn't quite reach me. Not that was as long as I kept my foot on it. So I did. I pushed harder, holding my wounded hand against my chest, feeling the warm blood mat the thick pelt that grew there. The rat twisted and flopped. Its tail first lashed my calf, then wrapped around it like a grass snake. Blood gushed from its mouth. Its black eyes bulged like marbles. I stood there with my foot on the dying rat for a long time. It was smashed to pieces inside, its innards reduced to gruel, and still it thrashed and tried to bite. Finally, it stopped moving. I stood on it for another minute, wanting to make sure it wasn't just playing possum. A rat playing possum. And when I was sure it was dead, I limped into the kitchen, leaving bloody footprints and thinking in a confused way of the oracle warning Peleus to beware of a man wearing just one sandal. But I was no Jason. I was a farmer half mad with pain and amazement, a farmer who seemed condemned to foul his sleeping place with blood. As I held my hand under the pump and froze it with cold water, I could hear someone saying, "No more! No more! No more!" It was me. I knew it was. But it sounded like an old man, one who had been reduced to beggary. I can remember the rest of that night, but it's like looking at old photographs in a mildewy album. The rat had bitten all the way through the webbing between my left thumb and forefinger, a terrible bite, but in a way lucky. If it had seized on the finger I'd hooked under that elastic cord, it might have bitten the finger entirely off. I realized that when I went back into the bedroom and picked up my adversary by the tail, using my right hand. The left was too stiff and painful to flex. It was 2 feet long, a 6-pounder at least. "Then it wasn't the same rat that escaped into the pipe," I hear you saying. "It couldn't have been." But it was! I tell you, it was. There was no identifying mark, no white patch of fur or conveniently memorable chewed ear, but I knew it was the one that had savaged Achilleus, just as I knew it hadn't been crouched up there by accident. I carried it into the kitchen by the tail and dumped it in the ash bucket. This I took out to our swill pit. I was naked in the pouring rain, but hardly aware of it. What I was mostly aware of was my left hand throbbing with a pain so intense it threatened to obliterate all thought. I took my duster from the hook in the mudroom, it was all I could manage, shrugged into it, and went out again, this time into the barn. I smeared my wounded hand with Raleigh salve. It had kept Achilleus's udder from infecting and might do the same for my hand. I started to leave, then remembered how the rat had escaped me last time. The pipe. I went to it and bent over, expecting to see the cement plug either chewed to pieces or completely gone, but it was intact. Of course it was. Even 6-pound rats with oversized teeth can't chew through concrete. That the idea had even crossed my mind shows the state I was in. For a moment I seemed to see myself as if from outside, a man, naked, except for an unbuttoned duster, his body hair matted with blood all the way to the groin, his torn left hand glistening under a thick snot-like coating of cow salve, his eyes bugging out of his head, the way the rats had bugged out when I stepped on it. It wasn't the same rat, I told myself. The one that bit Achilleus is either lying dead in the pipe or in Arlette's lap. But I knew it was. I knew it then, and I know it now. It was. Back in the bedroom, I got down on my knees and picked up the blood-stained money. It was slow work with only one hand. Once I bumped my torn hand on the side of the bed and howled with pain. I could see fresh blood staining the salve, turning it pink. I put the cash on the dresser, not even bothering to cover it with a book or one of Arlette's damned ornamental plates. I couldn't even remember why it had seemed so important to hide the bills in the first place. The red hat box I kicked into the closet and then slammed the door. It could stay there until the end of time for all of me. Anyone who's ever owned a farm or worked on one will tell you that accidents are commonplace and precautions must be taken. I had a big roll of bandage in the chest beside the kitchen pump, the chest Arlette had always called the hurt locker. I started to get the roll out, but then the big pot steaming on the stove caught my eye. The water I'd put on for a bath when I was still whole, and when such monstrous pain as that which seemed to be consuming me was only theoretical. It occurred to me that hot, soapy water might be just the thing for my hand.
The wound couldn't hurt any worse, I reasoned, and the immersion would cleanse it. I was wrong on both counts, but how was I to know? All these years later, it still seems like a reasonable idea. I suppose it might even have worked if I'd been bitten by an ordinary rat. I used my good right hand to ladle hot water into a basin. The idea of tilting the pot and pouring from it was out of the question. Then added a cake of Arlette's coarse brown washing soap. The last cake, as it turned out. There are so many supplies a man neglects to lay in when he's not used to doing it. I added a rag, then went into the bedroom, got down on my knees again, and began mopping up the blood and guts, all the time remembering, of course, the last time I had cleaned blood from the floor in that damned bedroom. That time at least Henry had been with me to share the horror. Doing it alone and in pain was a terrible job. My shadow bumped and flitted on the wall, making me think of Quasimodo in Hugo's Notre Dame de Paris. With the job almost finished, I stopped and cocked my head, breath held, eyes wide, my heart seeming to thud in my bitten left hand. I heard a scuttering sound, and it seemed to come from everywhere. The sound of running rats. In that moment, I was sure of it. The rats from the well, her loyal courtiers. They'd found another way out. The one crouched on top of the red hat box had only been the first and the boldest. They had infiltrated the house. They were in the walls. And soon they would come out and overwhelm me. She would have her revenge. I would hear her laughing as they tore me to pieces. The wind gusted hard enough to shake the house and shriek briefly along the eaves. The scuttering sound intensified, then faded a bit when the wind died. The relief that filled me was so intense it overwhelmed the pain, for a few seconds at least. It wasn't rats. It was sleet. With the coming of dark, the temperature had fallen and the rain had become semi-solid. I went back to scrubbing away the remains. When I was done, I dumped the bloody wash water over the porch rail, then went back to the barn to apply a fresh coating of salve to my hand. With the wound completely cleansed, I could see that the webbing between my thumb and forefinger was torn open in three slashes that looked like a sergeant's stripes. My left thumb hung askew, as if the rat's teeth had severed some important cable between it and the rest of my left hand. I applied the cow goop and then plodded back to the house, thinking, "It hurts, but at least it's clean." Achilles was all right. I'll be all right, too. Everything's fine. I tried to imagine my body's defenses mobilizing and arriving at the scene of the bite like tiny firemen in red hats and long canvas coats. At the bottom of the hurt locker, wrapped in a torn piece of silk that might once have been part of a lady's slip, I found a bottle of pills from the Hemingford Home Drugstore. Fountain penned on the label in neat capital letters was Arlette James. Take one or two at bedtime for monthly pain. I took three with a large shot of whiskey. I don't know what was in those pills. Morphia, I suppose. But they did the trick. The pain was still there, but it seemed to belong to a Wilfred James currently existing on some other level of reality. My head swam. The ceiling began to turn gently above me. The image of tiny firemen arriving to douse the blaze of infection before it could take hold grew clearer. The wind was strengthening, and to my half-dreaming mind, the constant low rattle of sleet against the house sounded more like rats than ever. But I knew better. I think I even said so aloud. "I know better, Arlette. You don't fool me." As consciousness dwindled and I began to slip away, I realized that I might be going for good, that the combination of shock, booze, and morphine might end my life. I would be found in a cold farmhouse, my skin blue-gray, my torn hand resting on my belly. The idea did not frighten me. On the contrary, it comforted me. While I slept,
The sleet turned to snow. When I woke at dawn the following morning, the house was as chilly as a tomb, and my hand had swelled up to twice its ordinary size. The flesh around the bite was ashy gray, but the first three fingers had gone a dull pink that would be red by the end of the day. Touching anywhere on that hand, except for the pinky, caused excruciating pain. Nevertheless, I wrapped it as tightly as I could, and that reduced the throbbing. I got a fire started in the kitchen stove. One-handed, it was a long job, but I managed, and then drew up close, trying to get warm, all of me except for the bitten hand that was. That part of me was warm already. Warm and pulsing, like a glove with a rat hiding inside it. By mid-afternoon, I was feverish, and my hand had swelled so tightly against the bandages that I had to loosen them. Just doing that made me cry out. I needed doctoring, but it was snowing harder than ever, and I wouldn't be able to get as far as Cotteries, let alone all the way to Hemmingford home. Even if the day had been clear and bright and dry, how would I ever have managed to crank the truck or the tea with just one hand? I sat in the kitchen, feeding the stove until it roared like a dragon, pouring sweat and shaking with cold, holding my bandaged club of a hand to my chest, and remembering the way kindly Mrs. MacReady had surveyed my cluttered, not particularly prosperous dooryard. "Are you on the exchange, Mr. James?" "I see you are not." No, I was not. I was by myself, on the farm I had killed for, with no means of summoning help. I could see the flesh beginning to turn red beyond where the bandages stopped, at the wrist, full of veins that would carry the poison all through my body. The fireman had failed. I thought of tying the wrist off with elastics, of killing my left hand in an effort to save the rest of me, and even of amputating it with the hatchet we used to chop up kindling and behead the occasional chicken. Both ideas seemed perfectly plausible, but they also seemed like too much work. In the end, I did nothing except hobble back to the hurt locker for more of Arlette's pills. I took three more, this time with cold water. My throat was burning, and then resumed my seat by the fire. I was going to die of the bite. I was sure of it, and resigned to it. Death from bites and infections was as common as dirt on the plains. If the pain became more than I could bear, I would swallow all the remaining pain pills at once. What kept me from doing it right away, apart from the fear of death, which I suppose afflicts all of us to a greater or lesser degree, was the possibility that someone might come, Harlan, or Sheriff Jones, or kindly Mrs. MacReady. It was even possible that Attorney Lester might show up to hector me some more about those goddamned 100 acres. But what I hoped most of all was that Henry might return. He didn't, though. It was Arlette who came. You may have wondered how I know about the gun Henry bought in the Dodge Street pawn shop and the bank robbery in Jefferson Square. If you did, you probably said to yourself, "Well, it's a lot of time between 1922 and 1930, enough to fill in plenty of details at a library stocked with back issues of the Omaha World Herald." I did go to the newspapers, of course, and I wrote to people who met my son and his pregnant girlfriend on their short, disastrous course from Nebraska to Nevada. Most of those people wrote back, willing enough to supply details. That sort of investigative work makes sense, and no doubt satisfies you. But those investigations came years later, after I left the farm and only confirmed what I already knew. Already, you ask? And I answer simply, yes, already. And I knew it not just as it happened, but at least part of it before it happened, the last part of it. How? The answer is simple. My dead wife told me. You disbelieve, of course. I understand that. Any rational person would. All I can do is reiterate that this is my confession, my last words on earth, and I've put nothing in it I don't know to be true. I woke from a doze in front of the stove the following night, or the next, as the fever settled in, I lost track of time, and heard the rustling, scuttering sounds again. At first I assumed it had recommenced sleeting, but when I got up to tear a chunk of bread from the hardening loaf on the counter, I saw a thin orange sunset streak on the horizon, and Venus glowing in the sky. The storm was over, but the scuttering sounds were louder than ever. They weren't coming from the walls, however, but from the back porch. The door latch began moving. At first it only trembled, as if the hand trying to operate it was too weak to lift it entirely clear of the notch. The movement ceased, and I had just decided I hadn't seen it at all, that it was a delusion born of the fever, when it went all the way up with a loud clack sound, and the door swung open on a cold breath of wind. Standing on the porch was my wife. She was still wearing her burlap snood, now flecked with snow. It must have been a slow and painful journey from what should have been her final resting place. Her face was slack with decay, the lower half slewed to one side, her grin wider than ever. It was a knowing grin. And why not? The dead understand everything. She was surrounded by her loyal court. It was they that had somehow gotten her out of the well. It was they that were holding her up. Without them, she would have been no more than a ghost, malevolent but helpless. But they had animated her. She was their queen. She was also their puppet. She came into the kitchen, moving with a horribly boneless gait that had nothing to do with walking. The rats scurried all around her, some looking up at her with love, some at me with hate. She swayed all the way around the kitchen, touring what had been her domain, as clods fell from the skirt of her dress. There was no sign of the quilt or the counterpane, and her head bobbed and rolled on her cut throat. Once it tilted back all the way to her shoulder blades before snapping forward again with a low and fleshy smacking sound. When she at last turned her cloudy eyes on me, I backed into the corner where the woodbox stood, now almost empty. "Leave me alone," I whispered. "You aren't even here. You're in the well, and you can't get out even if you're not dead." She made a gurgling noise. It sounded like someone choking on thick gravy, and kept coming, real enough to cast a shadow. And I could smell her decaying flesh. This woman who had sometimes put her tongue in my mouth during the throes of her passion. She was there. She was real. So was her royal retinue. I could feel them scurrying back and forth over my feet and tickling my ankles with their whiskers as they sniffed at the bottoms of my long-john trousers. My heels struck the wood box, and when I tried to bend away from the approaching corpse, I overbalanced and sat down in it. I banged my swollen and infected hand, but hardly registered the pain. She was bending over me, and her face dangled. The flesh had come loose from the bones, and her face hung down like a face drawn on a child's balloon. A rat climbed the side of the woodbox, plopped onto my belly, ran up my chest, and sniffed at the underside of my chin. I could feel others scurrying around beneath my bent knees, but they didn't bite me. That particular task had already been accomplished. She bent closer. The smell of her was overwhelming, and her cocked ear-to-ear grin. I can see it now as I write. I told myself to die, but my heart kept pounding. Her hanging face slid alongside mine. I could feel my beard stubble pulling off tiny bits of her skin, could hear her broken jaw grinding, like a branch with ice on it. Then her cold lips were pressed against the burning, feverish cup of my ear, and she began whispering secrets that only a dead woman could know. I shrieked. I promised to kill myself and take her place in hell if she would only stop, but she didn't. She wouldn't. The dead don't stop. That's what I know now. After fleeing the First Agricultural Bank with $200 stuffed into his pocket, or probably more like $150, some of it went on the floor, remember? Henry disappeared for a little while. He laid low in the criminal parlance. I say this with a certain pride. I thought he would be caught almost immediately after he got to the city, but he proved me wrong. He was in love. He was desperate. He was still burning with guilt and horror over the crime he and I had committed. But in spite of those distractions, those infections, my son demonstrated bravery and cleverness, even a certain sad nobility. The thought of that last is the worst. It still fills me with melancholy for his wasted life. 3 wasted lives. I mustn't forget poor pregnant Shannon Cottery. And shame for the ruination to which I led him, like a calf with a rope around its neck. Arlette showed me the shack where he went to ground, and the bicycle stashed out back. That bicycle was the first thing he purchased with his stolen cash. I couldn't have told you then exactly where his hideout was, but in the years since, I have located it and even visited it. Just a side of the road lean-to, with a fading Royal Crown Cola advertisement painted on the side. It was a few miles beyond Omaha's western outskirts and within sight of Boys Town, which had begun operating the year before. 1 room, a single glassless window, and no stove. He covered the bicycle with hay and weeds and laid his plans. Then, a week or so after robbing the First Agricultural Bank, by then police interest in a very minor robbery would have died down, he began making bicycle trips into Omaha. A thick boy would have gone directly to the St. Eusebia Catholic home and been snared by the Omaha cops, as Sheriff Jones had no doubt expected he would be. But Henry Freeman James was smarter than that. He sussed out the home's location, but didn't approach it. Instead, he looked for the nearest candy store and soda fountain. He correctly assumed that the girls would frequent it whenever they could, which was whenever their behavior merited a free afternoon and they had a little money in their bags. And although the St. Eusebia girls weren't required to wear uniforms, they were easy enough to pick out by their dowdy dresses, downcast eyes, and their behavior, alternately flirty and skittish. Those with big bellies and no wedding rings would have been particularly conspicuous. A thick boy would have attempted to strike up a conversation with one of these unfortunate daughters of Eve right there at the soda fountain, thus attracting attention. Henry took up a position outside, at the mouth of an alley running between the candy store and the notion shop next to it, sitting on a crate and reading the newspaper with his bike leaning against the brick next to him. He was waiting for a girl a little more adventurous than those content simply to sip their ice cream sodas and then scuttle back to the sisters. That meant a girl who smoked. On his third afternoon in the alley, such a girl arrived. I have found her since and talked with her. There wasn't much detective work involved. I'm sure Omaha seemed like a metropolis to Henry and Shannon, but in 1922, it was really just a larger-than-average Midwestern town with city pretensions. Victoria Hallett is a respectable married woman with 3 children now, but in the fall of 1922, she was Victoria Stevenson, young, curious, rebellious, 6 months pregnant, and very fond of sweet caporals. She was happy enough to take one of Henry's when he offered her the pack. "Take another couple for later," he invited. She laughed. "I'd have to be a ding-dong to do that. The sisters search our bags and pull our pockets inside out when we come back. I'll have to chew 3 sticks of blackjack just to get the smell of this one fag off my breath." She patted her bulging tummy with amusement and defiance. I'm in trouble, as I guess you can see. Bad girl. And my sweetie ran off. Bad boy. But the world don't care about that. So then the Dapper stuck me in a jail with penguins for guards. I don't get you. Geez, the Dapper's my dad. And penguins is what we call the sisters. She laughed. You're some country palooka, all right. And how? Anyway, the jail where I'm doing time's called St. Eusebius. Now you're cooking with gas, Jackson. She puffed her cig, narrowed her eyes. Say, I bet I know who you are. Shan Cottery's boyfriend. Give that girl a Cupid doll, Hank said. Well, I wouldn't get within 2 blocks of our place. That's my advice. The cops have got your description. She laughed cheerily. Yours and 6 other lonesome Lennies, but none of them green-eyed clodhoppers like you, and none with gals as good-looking as Shannon. She's a real Sheba. Yow! Why do you think I'm here instead of there? I'll bite. Why are you here? I want to get in touch, but I don't want to get caught doing it. I'll give you 2 bucks to take a note to her. Victoria's eyes went wide. Buddy, for a 2-spot, I'd tuck a bugle under my arm and take a message to Garcia. That's how tapped out I am. Hand it over! And another 2, if you keep your mouth shut about it, now and later. For that, you don't have to pay extra, she said. I love pulling the business on those holier-than-thou bitches. Why, they smack your hand if you try to take an extra dinner roll. It's like Gulliver Twist. He gave her the note, and Victoria gave it to Shannon. It was in her little bag of things when the police finally caught up with her and Henry in Elko, Nevada. And I have seen a police photograph of it. But Arlette told me what it said long before then, and the actual item matched, word for word. I'll wait from midnight to dawn, behind your place every night, for 2 weeks, the note said. If you don't show up, I'll know it's over between us and go back to Hemmingford and never bother you again, even though I will go on loving you forever. We are young, but we could lie about our ages and start a good life in another place. California? I have some money and know how to get more. Victoria knows how to find me if you want to send me a note, but only once. More would not be safe. I suppose Harlan and Sally Cottery might have that note. If so, they have seen that my son signed his name in a heart. I wonder if that was what convinced Shannon. I wonder if she even needed convincing. It's possible that all she wanted on earth was to keep and legitimize a baby she had already fallen in love with. That's a question Arlette's terrible whispering voice never addressed. Probably she didn't care, one way or the other. Henry returned to the mouth of the alley every day after that meeting. I'm sure he knew that the cops might arrive instead of Victoria, but felt he had no choice. On the 3rd day of his vigil, she came. Shan wrote back right away, but I couldn't get out any sooner, she said. Some goofy weed showed up in that hole they have the nerve to call a music room, and the penguins have been on the warpath ever since. Henry held out his hand for the note, which Victoria gave over in exchange for a sweet caporal. There were only 4 words. Tomorrow morning, 2 o'clock. Henry threw his arms around Victoria and kissed her. She laughed with excitement, eyes sparkling. Gosh, some girls get all the luck. They undoubtedly do, but when you consider that Victoria ended up with a husband, 3 kids, and a nice home on Maple Street in the best part of Omaha, and Shannon Cottery didn't live out that curse of a year, which of them would you say struck lucky? I have some money and know how to get more, Henry had written, and he did. Only hours after kissing the saucy Victoria, who took the message, he says he'll be there with bells on, back to Shannon, A young man with a flat cap pulled low on his forehead and a bandana over his mouth and nose robbed the First National Bank of Omaha. This time the robber got $800, which was a fine haul. But the guard was younger and more enthusiastic about his responsibilities, which was not so fine. The thief had to shoot him in the thigh in order to effect his escape, and although Charles Greiner lived, an infection set in, I could sympathize, and he lost the leg. When I met with him at his parents' house in the spring of 1925, Greiner was philosophical about it. "I'm lucky to be alive at all," he said. "By the time they got a tourniquet on my leg, I was lying in a pool of blood, damn near an inch deep. I bet it took a whole box of Dreft to get that mess up." When I tried to apologize for my son, he waved it away. I never should have approached him. The cap was pulled low and the bandana was yanked high, but I could see his eyes all right. I should have known. He wasn't going to stop unless he was shot down, and I never had a chance to pull my gun. It was in his eyes, see? But I was young myself. I'm older now. Older's something your son never got a chance to get. I'm sorry for your loss. After that job, Henry had more than enough money to buy a car, a nice one, a tourer. But he knew better. Writing that, I again feel that sense of pride, low but undeniable. A kid who looked like he only started shaving a week or two before, waving around enough wampum to buy an almost new Olds, that would have brought John Law down on him for sure. So instead of buying